The insurgency in Iraq has created an increasingly dangerous environment for U.S. and foreign forces in Iraq. The Green Zone, however, has been, for the most part, a safe haven for foreigners. The Green Zone, as many of you know, is where the U.S. forces have made their home in Baghdad, a park-like expanse covering 4 square miles that includes the palace of the former dictator Saddam Hussein. William Longavisha is a national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. He says the Green Zone remains an oasis in the middle of chaos. His article, Welcome to the Green Zone, in this month's cover story of the Atlantic Monthly, and he joins us now by phone from Amman, Jordan. And thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
You were just in Iraq as recently as this morning. You spent most of the past year there. How would you describe the difference between life in the Green Zone and life outside it?
It's pretty simple, really. Life in the Green Zone has proved to be safe. We should say that the Green Zone is the center of not of the U.S. forces, but of the U.S. civilian administration and the attendant contractors, civilian contractors. It's essentially a civilian place, though it is protected by soldiers. It has proved to be quite safe. As far as I know, there's only been one really known and proved fatality there. Mortars come in most days, most nights, but it's a very large area, mostly empty, and most of these mortars, almost all of them, have exploded harmlessly, mortars and rockets.
As we mentioned, the Republican Palace, the center of government in the old days, is still there, and I guess in some ways is still the center of government.
When the U.S. forces came in following the invasion, they immediately set up shop, I mean the civilian administration did, in the buildings of the former regime. This was convenient at the time and was probably a mark of wanting to engage with the Iraqi people. There were problems, however. The force protection requirements of the U.S. meant that very quickly it became a fortress. To protect yourself, of course, you erect walls, you defend it with guards. And this changed over time as the situation deteriorated and finally became something of a prison for the U.S. presence in Iraq.
A lot of people have been looking for metaphors to explain what's gone on between the American rulers in Iraq. Well, obviously, there's an interim government there now, but the American rulers in Iraq and the Iraqi people. You write a lot in your article about traffic.
Right. You can see in the difference between the inside and the outside a lot of what characterizes the American occupation in Iraq. On the inside, the traffic is quiet. It's mostly Americans, mostly driving nicely in their shiny SUVs, going nowhere, staying inside the walls, and drifting between the various offices and the few bars and restaurants that have been set up to serve them, their houses as well, or quarters. On the outside, Baghdad, and we should say that the Green Zone is at the center of the city, Baghdad has become a chaos of traffic. A lot of cars, mostly stolen, have poured in since the invasion. And the police, of course, the forces of order have broken down. They remain broken down today. And as a result, a sort of extreme form of traffic has resulted. And it is chaos. It is gridlock. It is high speed. It is anarchic in violent ways and in some ways represents the state of Iraqi society today.
You write about the efforts of an American official inside the Green Zone, a lawyer from Maryland who thought his gift to the Iraqi people would be a new traffic code.
Right. A typical story, really, for the Green Zone. And this also, it should be said, this guy was well-intentioned, and he was probably quite smart. But he was faced with the demand from on high to do something about this anarchy on the outside. And the solution he found was the homegrown solution. Let us basically impose the Maryland State Traffic Code on Iraq. This was his idea. It was somewhat modified. It didn't work at all. And when the Iraqis were presented with this as a legal proposal, the Iraqi traffic police threw up their hands in amazement. This has happened often, again and again, with American initiatives in Iraq. They had a traffic code. It had been suspended by the United States, by American forces, because of perceived corruption, petty corruption among the traffic police. There were problems.
Yet you write that essentially the Americans were not worldly enough to accept this minor corruption with the Iraqi traffic cops.
There was a puritanical thing going on. I mean, the Americans being the Puritans, and all corruption is bad. They didn't have the worldliness to see how corruption works in places like Iraq on a small level, where it may be a legitimate form, actually, of payment for the forces of order. It may be a legitimate form of or informal form of taxation. And they just saw corruption. Corruption is bad, and they shut it down.
Mm-hmm. And all of this accompanied by bad translations of differing proposals. At one point, the Americans thought that the Iraqis they were working with wanted to ban smoking while driving.
Ban smoking, ban the use of cell phones, require seat belts, which is something of a joke in Iraq, and ban standing up on seats in cars as if this were a big problem. These were translation problems, and a conversation ensued among the Americans that I write about here, in which they got involved in an earnest discussion about which is more dangerous for a society, smoking or the use of cell phones while driving. I mean, this conversation was going on when on the outside of the green zone, people were getting shot, blown up, mortars were going off. I mean, who cares about cell phones?
And all of this, as by extension, at the hands of these civilian employees. Now, we see a fair amount of American forces in Iraq, but tell us a little bit more about who are these civilians who are living and working in the green zone.
At the core is our government officials. They come in typically for a few months at a time. They have very little knowledge of Iraq and no contact with Iraq, really, for the most part, once they get there, because now force protection rules require them not to go outside of the green zone. They might as well be in Des Moines, actually, except for the mortars coming in. For a long time, it was the CPA, Coalition Provisional Authority, under Paul Bremer, the occupation government. Since June 28th, it has been the State Department, so a very powerful embassy, and which has really served much of the same role, strongly advising the new Iraqi government.
And are these young men and women who are there, are they ideologues?
They were in the beginning. I think that the perception in the press corps was that this was a right-wing construct, a sort of neocon thing, and there's some legitimacy to that in the beginning. But as time went on and they had to deal with some of the realities, the ideologues either left or mellowed and new crowds came in. I think it's unfair to call them right-wingers now. They tend to believe in the validity and the necessity of the American invasion of Iraq that puts them on a certain side of an American divide. But they are not, I think, for the most part, just a bunch of right-wingers. Mostly what they are, if you had to say, characterize them in some way, is naive, young, arrogant, the way America can be arrogant. They think they know better than the Iraqis, and they, of course, they don't. That's one of the big problems in Iraq today.
Anybody who's visited an American base overseas is almost universally taken by the way that the U.S. military has managed to recreate a small piece of America wherever that may be, in an aircraft carrier floating off in the Persian Gulf or in a base in Germany or anywhere else in the world. Has that happened in the green zone?
Sure it has, yeah. But, I mean, the standard stuff, the PX and the telephones in the green zone work with American area codes. You might as well be in either suburban New York or in suburban Virginia. And the televisions are tuned into American channels and so forth. The food is American food, institutional food provided by Kellogg Brown and Root, as on the military places.
We're talking with William Longavisha, a national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly, about his cover story in the current issue of the magazine, Welcome to the Green Zone. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. At the same time, while this sort of American-subsidized, air-conditioned existence goes on inside the bubble, the Green Zone, you write a lot about some of the explosion of enterprise throughout Baghdad.
Right. On the outside is anarchy. On the inside is America. On the outside is anarchy. And that anarchy has brought with it a lot of economic activity. I mean, there's something to be said for anarchy. This anarchy is not, as the American officials have claimed, the result of wise American policy. This anarchy is the result of taking the lid off 30 years of oppressive government in Iraq. And people now are given the opportunity through chaos to do what they want. That means they can shoot at Americans if they want, and they'll get away with it. And it also means that they can set up shops and import bananas, as I point out. So there is a lot of initiative in Iraq. And the question for us now as a country is how much of that initiative is turning into anti-American violence.
Mm-hmm. And through all of this, the Green Zone, this oasis, has become somewhat less safe of late.
I'm not sure that's measurable. Yes, there was an explosive device that is said to have been found outside the Green Zone Cafe, one of the eating establishments, a couple days ago. Was it 3 days ago?
Mm-hmm.
And the feverish alert, security alert, went out as usual via email. Don't walk anywhere unaccompanied. Minimize your movements within the Green Zone, et cetera, et cetera. But we've seen this before. I mean, this has happened every time there's a perceived attack inside the Green Zone. The reaction is feverish. And I have heard on, I think, fairly reliable sources that you could say at least there is some question, in this, even in this case, that there was an explosive device found. I think many people now believe that this was, through complicated mechanisms of bureaucratic reporting, inflated, at least.
Mm-hmm.
I was recently, in fact, yesterday, in the Green Zone Cafe, and it appeared pretty normal to me.
One thing most people don't understand is that thousands of Iraqi civilians live in the Green Zone.
No one knows exactly how many. They've been there since the start. They were initially squatters, and also Iraqi officials and expatriate elites, Iraqi elites, who came back in and reclaimed some of the beautiful villas that exist inside the Green Zone. So the numbers are unknown. I've been working on the number of about 5,000. Recently there have been some higher numbers. I'm a little skeptical of that. But the fact is nobody knows how many live on the inside.
It's roughly the same number as the number of foreigners who live in the Green Zone.
It's roughly the same number, but they are a suppressed minority, at least culturally. I mean, they are there, you do see them, but they keep a very low profile. There's a lot of nervousness about them. There's concern that these are, you know, inside agents of the insurgents. Usually, of course, this is wrong. But the point is that the Green Zone is overwhelmingly an American place. So though the numbers may be equal, the power is by no means equal.
Talk to us a little bit about the frustrations of reporting in Iraq these days. It's very difficult for reporters to move around the country.
Reporters do not live inside the Green Zone, not allowed in.
Mm-hmm.
The only foreigners or Westerners allowed inside the Green Zone are either government officials or their contractors. So reporters are on the outside, as are some contractors and some businessmen, though very few of them. People live fort to fort, fortified position to fortified position, and there's increasingly little interaction with Iraq as they move in hurried and frightened cars, convoys sometimes, or single cars if they're taking the low-profile route, and they go to some place where they may be safe for a few hours or overnight.
Given those difficulties, is there any way that any reporter, no matter how diligent, can really report this story?
I've been wondering that, and I don't have an answer for it. I think clearly the daily reporting has this explosion here, that explosion there, and what the effect is on the Iraqi people, where most of the suffering occurs. This has probably gotten more sketchy. On the other hand, given the nature of daily reporting and the schedule imposed on reporters by editors back home, give us the news, you know, news peg and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's possible that the reporting from Iraq, which has not been brilliant, may improve. I was talking to a reporter last night about that, and he talked about how his schedule has changed. He now has 3 or 4 days and sometimes even weeks to develop a story, and then by the time he writes it, he actually has several days or several weeks behind him. And there may be, we may see as a result, oddly enough, of this restricted movement, a little more depth coming out of the newspapers.
William Longavisha, thanks very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
William Longavisha, national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. His article, Welcome to the Green Zone, this month's cover story of the magazine. He joined us by phone from Amman, Jordan. In Washington, I'm Neil Conan, NPR News.